I'm Audie Cornish, host of The Assignment, a new weekly podcast from CNN. We're going to talk about things you might not want to bring up at the dinner table, from the economy of sex work to the politics of school boards.
We need more critical thinking. We need to be teaching our kids to think for themselves.
Unless a parent thinks it's inappropriate. Then they can make a phone call to a tip line, right? And say, I didn't like the way that went down.
And that's a discussion to be had between the school board and the parent.
Conversations with everyday people who don't make the headlines, they live them. Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on Spotify.
Cubans are leaving their island in record numbers. If you want to know why, ask a cab driver.
Una goma de un carro está valiendo ahora mismo.
This taxi driver in Havana says it took him about 3 months' pay to afford one new tire. Also today, Vietnam's president resigns, or did he get the boot?
It's really a political power play. Vietnamese politics are very elite. They're very secretive. It all happens behind closed doors.
We open the door to hear the backstory. Plus, young women say goodbye to the name Brownies up in Canada. The members were ready to make the change.
We said to them, you know, sometimes some of the girls who are your age feel like they don't belong because of this name. Their automatic reaction was, well, we should change it.
And why South African seals are getting so aggressive, all that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us. We begin today on the migration beat, specifically migration from Cuba. Huge numbers of Cubans are fleeing their island and coming to the United States. Nearly a quarter million in the past year alone. It's an exodus of record proportions, the largest single wave of Cuban migrants since Fidel Castro's revolution in the 1950s. The World's TV's Isaiah has more about why it's happening.
Daniel, a 38-year-old taxi driver from Havana, has tried to leave Cuba three times. Always by sea, he says, on homemade wooden boats. Daniel speaks with me from Havana and asked me not to use his last name. It's illegal for Cubans to try to leave the country by sea. We build boats in hidden places, and we don't tell anyone about our plans, he says, not even family members. He recalls all his previous unsuccessful attempts to flee Cuba. On the first one, his boat was caught by the U.S. Coast Guard and everyone was repatriated back to the island. The second time, it was Cuban authorities who saw them leaving and made them pay a fine. And then, the third time, we had to jump off the boat and swim 5 miles back, he tells me, to avoid being caught by the Cuban Coast Guard again. Hundreds of these boats have been leaving from the shores of Cuba, which is just 90 miles south of Florida's coast. Others have been taking charter flights to Nicaragua. It's the only country in Central America that doesn't require a visa for Cubans. And from there, they travel north into Mexico toward the U.S. border.
It is an unprecedented exodus of Cubans that we are seeing.
Maria Carla Nordaste is the director of the Cuban program at the Washington Office for Latin America. She says life in Cuba has been difficult for a long time, but things got worse after the pandemic and two hurricanes hit the island.
Cuba's facing its worst economic crisis in decades, so even worse than the 1990s special period.
The tourism industry is one of the main sources of income for Cuba, but it has been devastated in recent years and hasn't been able to rebound. Yaniel, the taxi driver, tells me it's hard to make ends meet. Everything is expensive and scarce, he says. Roads are in terrible condition, and that takes a toll on his taxi. A single tire costs about $120, he says, and that's about 3 months of his salary. I don't have any money, he says. I can only buy some food, and it's not enough. Mario Cáceres is a software engineer who works in a restaurant in Santiago de Cuba. His monthly salary is enough for about 2 weeks' worth of expenses. So he and his wife are selling pizza slices at home to make a living.
He
says education doesn't have any value in Cuba. Even educated people are still poor. Cáceres says there are daily power outages that last between 4 and 6 hours. And sometimes the restaurant where he works has to close and he makes less money. U.S. sanctions on Cuba are also having an impact. The Trump administration imposed a maximum pressure policy. Direct flights to Cuba were canceled. Remittances from abroad were halted. The U.S. consulate in Cuba was closed for a few years, blocking legal pathways for migration. And all this has put pressure on Cubans to leave. That's according to Andrew Seeley with the Migration Policy Institute in Washington.
So on one hand, you have a closure of the legal options. And then last year, Nicaragua began to allow people to travel from Cuba. And it opened up a way for people to come very easily to Nicaragua and then onward to the U.S. border. You know, this has all happened at a time where people really want out.
President Biden has made some changes. U.S. consulate services in Havana resumed 2 weeks ago. The ban on remittances was lifted, and there is a new legal way for Cubans to come to the U.S. They can get a work permit if they pass a background check and find a sponsor. Daniel, the taxi driver, says he's heard about people offering to be sponsor for Cubans, but some of them are asking for up to $10,000. So he says he's helping to build another wooden boat to try and leave the country for the fourth time.
No hay esperanza de que esto mejore. No hay futuro.
I have no hope, he says. There is no future in Cuba. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaya.
A big victory for the independent media today in the Philippines. Nobel Peace Prize laureate and journalist Maria Ressa was acquitted of tax evasion. A Philippine court's decision ended a years-long legal battle that many saw as an attempt to silence Filipino journalists like Ressa, who were critical of the government. Today, Maria Ressa spoke after the verdict outside the courtroom.
These charges, as you know, were politically motivated. They were incredible to us. A brazen abuse of power and meant to stop journalists from doing their jobs.
Reporter Ashley Westerman is in Manila and joins us to talk more about the verdict. Welcome, Ashley. What was Ressa, and by extension her news site Rappler, actually being accused of?
Yeah, so this is a bit thick, Marco, so bear with me. The Philippine Bureau of Internal Revenue has accused Ressa and Rappler's parent holding company, Rappler Holding Corporation, of falsifying tax returns in 2015. Media lawyer Frank Lloyd Tsungson explains the charge.
Because of not declaring that income, they willfully tried to evade paying taxes. So that resulted in a charge for tax evasion.
And how did Ressa and Rappler respond to these accusations of tax evasion?
So when the lawsuit was filed in 2018, Maria Ressa, facing 34 years in prison for this, pleaded not guilty. Tsungson says the defendants argued that Rappler's parent company did make these transactions with two foreign entities, but they did it to build capital, not to earn income.
And there's a very big difference between income and capital. So since there's no income that was derived from the transaction, then it means that there's nothing to be taxed.
And Ressa has repeatedly called this and other attacks on her and her news website harassment in an attempt by former President Rodrigo Duterte's government to silence journalists. Now, you have to remember, Marco, that Duterte and Rappler have a contentious relationship because of Rappler's coverage of Duterte's administration, particularly his deadly war on drugs. And this case is just one example, advocates say, of how the Duterte administration attempted to weaponize the courts to silence journalists they didn't like.
So why did the court throw out this tax evasion case? What was the reason?
Well, basically, the Philippine Court of Tax Appeals said the government could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the transactions in question derived any income. And so it couldn't be proven that the defendants were liable to pay taxes on that income.
Okay, so this was a case that went to a tax court. What does this mean for press freedom moving forward?
Yeah, so this is a big deal, and this decision is being held as a win for press freedom here in the Philippines. As soon as the verdict came down, a slew of congratulations to Ressa and Rappler from press and human rights advocates were issued online. Jonathan DeSantos is the chairperson of the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines, and he calls this a rare victory.
Because we have been under attack for the past 6 years, a lot of those attacks have been through legal cases. And we're seeing this win as a possible reversal to basically the use of legal cases like to get back at or to intimidate journalists.
And you know, Marco, it's also being seen as sort of a first test for the press here on whether or not they're going to have as much trouble with the new government of President Bongbong Marcos as they did the last 6 years with Duterte. The new president took office in June and was propelled there, if you remember, by a major misinformation campaign on social media.
Mm-hmm.
Now, DeSantos says, to be fair, the Marcos administration has been media friendly so far. But, you know, the fight isn't over for Maria Ressa and Rappler. She still has three more legal cases pending, including a cyber libel case in the appeals process. So people will be watching those decisions closely, especially after today.
Reporter Ashley Westerman in Manila giving us the latest on the acquittal of Filipina journalist Maria Ressa and her outlet Rappler Media on charges of tax evasion. Ashley, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The Girl Guides of Canada, Canada's equivalent of the Girl Scouts, they're no stranger to change. In 2010, they removed mentions of God and religion from their messaging. 5 years later, they formally welcomed transgender girls as members. Now they're losing the name Brownies. Current and former members of the Girl Guides of Canada say the name causes harm to people of color. The World's Bianca Hillier has the details.
In a video on social media posted last fall, the Girl Guides of Canada apologized to members for the impacts of the original name.
We said that you'll be accepted, respected, and included. But we know that's not always felt true. It's clear that it's time to make a change. We cannot use a name that causes harm.
CEO Jill Zelmanovitz said the move came, in part, after former members said they didn't want their daughters joining the organization because they'd been harmed by the name as a kid. Other former members said they simply left Girl Guides when they were 7 and 8 years old, as those are the years when members are part of the Brownies branch. Girl Guides of Canada declined the World's interview request, but Zelmanovitz told CTV how the organization went about picking the new name.
We did a lot of focus groups with girls inside and outside the organization. Obviously, we had, you know, lots of names, but they were already taken by other organizations, so there's always trademark considerations to take into account.
Girl Guides also consulted the National Indigenous Advisory Circle and other community partners. Over the past few months, tens of thousands of members and troop leaders voted for which new name they liked best. The Girl Guides announced the results on social media. These young girls are now the Embers.
As an Ember, you have potential that's just waiting to be unleashed. You're glowing and ready to start something incredible.
Zelmanovitz said the reaction has been fairly positive overall, but especially among the 7 and 8 year old Embers themselves.
We anticipated at Girl Guides that we'd be having a lot of difficult conversations, but I will say that the least difficult conversations were with this age group. And when we said to them, you know, sometimes some of the girls who are your age feel like they don't belong because of this name, their automatic reaction was, well, we should change it.
The name Brownies will still be used in similar organizations around the world, which all fall under the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts. Girl Scouts of the USA said in a statement they're currently evaluating their programs to make sure they're anti-racist. And Britain's Girl Guiding said they've talked it through with members and do not plan to nix the Brownies name. Canada's Girl Guides is asking people to use the new Embers name immediately and says it will be fully integrated into their website, marketing materials, and training sessions by September. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A Ukrainian member of parliament told us there is one word to describe how this week feels: grief. Today, it's grief for a colleague killed in this morning's helicopter crash. That conversation is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The helicopter that crashed near a kindergarten in a Kyiv suburb today took the lives of at least 18 people, among them Ukraine's Interior Minister Denis Monastirsky.
Сьогодні українець – символ воїнства.
This is Monastirsky in a video the Ministry of Internal Affairs posted yesterday. He's addressing soldiers in the Ukrainian National Guard before giving them service awards.
Здоров'я, сили, нерви, і кожен з вас розуміє, яку ціну.
Monastirsky told the soldiers, each of them is a hero who showed personal courage and bravery in their military duty. Monastirsky is the most senior Ukrainian official to die since Russia invaded Ukraine almost a year ago. Maria Mezentseva knew several officials killed on today's helicopter crash, including Monastirsky. As a member of Ukraine's parliament, she worked closely with him. We reached MP Mezentseva in Davos, Switzerland, at the World Economic Forum.
It's just devastating. You know, in the morning when we came to Davos session on Russian accountability, we saw the news, and I thought it should be possibly a fake. When our party chat started being filled up with messages from the parliament saying, well, look, this is true. Denis died, not only him, but everyone who was there. I started crying. My first reaction, I started crying as well as my other female colleagues next to me. You know, he was our colleague in the parliament. We were interacting in a daily basis. Moreover, he supported President Zelensky from day one, being in his team during the campaign, the presidency campaign. I think it's a huge loss. I'm sure it's a huge loss for president personally.
So Denis Monastirsky was the interior minister, as we mentioned. The portfolio for that ministry is really big. It includes the police force and security throughout all of Ukraine. How did his job change during the past year of war?
It has been intensified, surely. This is absolutely outrageous circumstances to work in. And I think Denis has been doing this job brilliantly, being able to ally members of parliament, other ministers. And we were together in Kharkiv in the end of summer. Denis was given awards to representatives of national police and other departments. And that was very touching. You can see how emotional and how personal he was addressing many situations. So it's just, you know, a little bit too much to take in one go of what has happened today in the morning.
Yeah, for sure. So Ukraine's government has appointed the national police chief, Ihor Klimenko, as a temporary acting interior minister. What's it going to be like for him to take on that role in the midst of the war?
I'm sure he will do a great job. The tragedy is that it actually has happened. Yeah. So I'm sure the emergency services, everyone who's involved in the investigative operation, will exhaustively describe what has happened and find the links to the activities. Some members who are in Kyiv right now, members of the parliament, they visited the spot. And they were sending me pictures, you know, of the children's shoes next to the kinder. It's heartbreaking. There would be no words to express this grief of ours. This means, you know, that this war is taking some different curves. We are expecting investigative team to come up with details.
Well, MP Mezentseva, you spoke about possible links, and I'm just wondering, links to what with this crash of this helicopter?
I cannot comment. I am very sorry, but this is, I think, the only special authorities are authorized to talk about technical capabilities of the aircraft, of the helicopter, actually, which might have led to the effect which we have seen today.
What does this crash mean, do you think, for the morale of the police and security forces in Ukraine, and really for all Ukrainians?
It's grief. We on daily basis are experiencing different ones. It might be a funeral of your friend. It might be a funeral of your friend who's serving in the battlefield, or who might have been killed by a shelling. But Ukrainian nation is as strong as it has never been. And this is what I'm seeing in every teacher, every medical servant, every police officer, every warrior at the battlefield, every business person who's paying taxes and making their business running. We are going through difficult times, maybe the most difficult times in our lifetime. But if this mission has arrived to us, and we've been fighting for our freedom for more than 1,000 years, if we go back in the history, like against actually Russians.
MP Mezentseva, what will you personally remember about Denis Monastirsky?
As I put our black and white picture on my social media on Instagram, I will always remember him smiling. And when I was saying, well, Denis, this is the worst law, piece of law we've been going through in a lifetime, he would always say, Maria, we can still consult with different stakeholders and win the situation for the best of the people of Ukraine. He was always sure about the successful result. That's what I liked the most in him.
Just one last thing, MP Mezentseva. President Zelensky commented, as you probably heard, how this has been such a terrible week already for Ukraine. First, the many lives lost in the apartment building that got hit by a missile in Dnipro, now this helicopter crash. I mean, as a member of parliament, what do you say to your constituents about how the war is going right now?
Well, my constituency was shelled numerously since day one of this brutal war, as Kharkiv was never occupied, but the region was occupied and was liberated in the first week of September. I think we, as the people of Kharkiv, the people of Oblast, we are very strong in our spirit. I'm constantly visiting people in the nearby territories to the front line, like 4-3 kilometers to the points where Russian position armies are. We are bringing the most needed things to children, which are many on the ground, to elderly people, to disabled people, to families. And, you know, sometimes people just need a hug and a smile. And that's what we're also happy to deliver. And being on the ground as a member of parliament is extremely important right now. So I'm coming back with good results for Davos. It's 500,000 Swiss francs dedicated specifically by Zurich Insurance Company for generators to Kharkiv region and many other good news, but you know, this day to day. So, I mean, sometimes you think there are no more tears to cry, yeah, for what is happening. But I will always remember in my heart and in my mind these people, even Secretary of State, I also knew him, Yevgen, who was deputy of Denis. We were all working together this 3 years' time for common goal of making our country more prosperous and developed back to European family. So I think here we can only, you know, pray to God that their souls will find peace and we will find the truth of what has actually happened.
Maria Mezentseva is a member of Ukraine's parliament and chairs its delegation to the Council of Europe. She worked closely with Ukraine's interior minister, Denis Monastirsky, who died today in a helicopter crash. MP Mezentseva, I know it's a tough day for you in Ukraine. We thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your support.
We'll be right back with more from around the globe. You're listening to The World. The city of Istanbul is destroying urban gardens dating back to the Roman Empire. Environmental activists say when they speak up within their own political party, they're told not to rock the boat.
As if we're sort of traitors from within, you know, that's how people view any kind of criticism.
Advocating on behalf of ancient gardens in Istanbul, that's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, this is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In his first days in office, Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has already made good on a series of promises to defend the Amazon. He's signed 7 executive orders aimed at environmental protection. Among them was the relaunch of the $1 billion Amazon Fund, where foreign governments can contribute to forest protection. Lula has also taken steps to empower Brazil's indigenous communities. In this final story in our 3-part series on the future of the Amazon, reporter Michael Fox looks at the big changes underway for Brazil's indigenous people and what they could mean for defending their native territories.
Last week, indigenous activists, leaders, and allies gathered at Brazil's National Indian Foundation, FUNAI. This was an agency that had previously protected indigenous rights and native land, but which under Bolsonaro had been defunded, gutted, and turned against them. Now, it was time to celebrate. It's so great to be back here. We haven't had a meeting here for a long time, the new director, Joenia Wapichana, told a packed crowd. And let's remember, she said, from now on, the National Indian Foundation will be named the National Foundation of Indigenous Peoples. Wapishana was Brazil's first indigenous lawyer and its first female indigenous lawmaker. She was elected in 2018 and served in Congress over the last 4 years. She said Lula had invited her personally to head the agency as its first indigenous director. It will be a challenge, she said, but she'll have help. FUNAI will now fall under the jurisdiction of Brazil's first Indigenous Peoples Ministry, led by prominent Indigenous activist Sonia Guajajara.
Sonia Guajajara, Ministra de Estado dos Povos Indígenas.
She was Lula's first cabinet minister to be sworn in on Inauguration Day. She wore a feather headdress and carried an Indigenous shaker in her right hand. Lula embraced her when she reached the podium. It's a moment of such great emotion, she said in her first speech to supporters. I've been telling a lot of people that I've never felt this excited, never in my life. But for all the excitement, her ministry faces huge challenges. Indigenous territories have been devastated in recent years. Fires, clear cuts, mining, logging. Amazon deforestation is at a 15-year high. Over half of the destruction in recent years has been on conservation areas and native territories. Indigenous peoples blame former President Jair Bolsonaro for pushing Amazon development and empowering illegal land grabbers. Nowhere is this clearer than on Caripuna territory in the Amazonian state of Rondônia. When I visited there a few months ago, Chief André Caripuna walked me through the jungle to see the latest destruction of their land. This was all just burned, said Caripuna, staring out over the charred remnants of a once pristine stretch of jungle. You can still see the smoke, he said. Less than a week ago, this was all green forest. Lula has promised to stop the land invasions and the deforestation.
Os povos indígenas precisam ter suas terras demarcadas e livres das ameaças.
The indigenous peoples need to have their land demarcated and free from the threats of illegal and predatory economic activities, Lula said during his inauguration speech. They're not obstacles to development. They're guardians of the rivers and forests and a fundamental piece of the greatness of our nation, he said. André Caripuna says he's excited about Lula's victory, but concerned for what lies ahead.
Tá muito avançado já as invasões aqui no território. Agora eu tô falando pouco só.
The invasions are really advanced, he says. We're hopeful that they'll be able to remove these invaders, but there's a lot to be resolved, he says. That's why the new indigenous leaders in Lula's government are hoping to take action fast. At the top of their agenda is restructuring the new agencies, removing land invaders, and demarcating new indigenous land. That was something Bolsonaro refused to do. This month, the Brazilian government is expected to recognize 13 new indigenous territories.
Para nós, esse momento é um momento histórico.
This is an historic moment, says indigenous rights defender Ingrid Sachiremawe. This is a moment to rewrite the history of the indigenous peoples of Brazil, she says. They have a long way to go, but indigenous leaders say now, like never before, is a moment of relief, of celebration, and of hope for them and for the protection of the Amazon rainforest. For the World, I'm Michael Fox.
Check out the entire series of our stories on the future of the Amazon on the web at theworld.org. When a high-level politician resigns, it often means they were forced out. That appears to be the case in a political drama unfolding in Vietnam. The president, Nguyen Xuan Phuc, resigned yesterday after days of rumors that he was on the outs. Politics are usually an opaque business in Vietnam, and we were wondering what was going on. Zachary Abuza has some ideas. He's a specialist on Southeast Asia at the National War College in Washington. Zachary, before you tell us why Vietnam's president resigned, give us a sense of who Nguyen Xuan Phuc is. What's he known for?
He's been president since 2021. Previous to that, he was the prime minister of the country from 2016 to 2021. And he oversaw a period of vast economic growth for the country. So he's really seen as an economic reformer.
Yeah, those are pretty good bona fides. Now for the why. What got him sacked?
Ostensibly, he is tied to corruption in the country, but it's really a political power play. You have to understand that Vietnamese politics are very elite. They're very secretive. It all happens behind closed doors. He was a member of the 18-member Politburo. Just 2 weeks ago, another Politburo member had lost his job. Phuc Nau is the second in 2 weeks. So it raises broader questions about what's happening. Since 2016, we've really watched the Communist Party leader grow very concerned that as Vietnam's economy has grown, as it has become, you know, this very important player in the global supply chain, that the economy has simply become too complex. Its decision-making, policy-making has fallen into the hands of technocratic elites. And that alarmed the Communist Party chief, who saw the Communist Party apparatus losing much of their authority, their decision-making power. In the past 2 weeks, we've seen two of the most competent deputy prime ministers ousted, and now Phuc, who's overseen this period of economic growth.
So who actually benefits from this shift at the top?
The first beneficiary would obviously be the general secretary of the Communist Party, who really viewed Phuc as the only real contender to replace him other than his own protege. So if he removed Phuc, he ensures that his protege succeeds him. The other person who's really going to benefit from this is most likely the Minister of Public Security, so the man in charge of the vast police and police state of Vietnam. He has an interest in becoming the president because he is actually term limited as the Minister of Public Security. He and his family have vast economic holdings that he is seeking to protect, and he is also hoping that from the presidency, which is more or less a ceremonial position in Vietnam, that he can continue to run the Ministry of Public Security. I should also note that the Minister of Public Security and his family are real players in the renewable energy sector in Vietnam. The other big player in that field is the ousted Phuc and his family. And so they're not just political rivals, they're commercial rivals.
How risky was it, though, to force out a president who's seen as a smart actor when it comes to economic growth? I mean, isn't economic growth key to political stability in Vietnam?
It is. The Communist Party garners so much of their legitimacy through performance. And last year, they had 8% growth. And in fact, the handling of the pandemic since 2020 has allowed Vietnam to have the fastest growing economy in Southeast Asia. The three people most responsible for their stellar COVID response have been ousted in the past 2 weeks. And so foreign investors should be very concerned that these very competent stewards of the economy are being replaced by people with just very little economic experience. And for a country like Vietnam that is so overly dependent on exports, heading into potentially a global recession, foreign investors should be very concerned.
So back to the underlying pressure, Zachary, that forced out President Nguyen Xuan Phuc. So his rivals get what they want, but what does the Communist Party get out of having now government officials who don't really get the economy?
I really don't know. I'm at a loss. My real concern right now is you're seeing institutional capture of the Politburo by the security forces. The Ministry of Public Security is just the dominant force in the country right now. Currently, 5 of the 16 members of the Politburo are either from the Ministry of Public Security or still there. If the current Minister of Public Security becomes the president, as I expect, his replacement will be on the Politburo. That will make the number 6 out of 17. That is absolute institutional capture by the Ministry of Public Security. And I think it's very indicative that the leadership is very insecure. They're terrified of colored revolutions, of losing the Communist Party's monopoly of power.
Colored revolutions, as in the ones that have popped up popular support, people power around the globe.
Exactly. And it's very frustrating because the Communist Party of Vietnam deserves inordinate credit for growing the economy as successfully as they have, creating this urban middle class. You know, even if you don't believe the 8% growth from last year, it was still the best performing in Southeast Asia. They have much to be proud of and secure of, and yet the leadership is very insecure.
Zachary Abuza is a specialist on Southeast Asia at the National War College in Washington, speaking with us about the resignation of Vietnam's president, Nguyen Xuan Phuc. Zach, thanks very much for the insight.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
If you stroll around Istanbul, you'll come across urban gardens that date back to Roman times. They are the remnants of the old city walls of ancient Constantinople and are still in use. They're known as the Yedikule Gardens. Historians believe they are almost 1,600 years old. But sections of these gardens are now being demolished for a city works project as part of a trend in Turkey where developers are taking over green spaces. From Istanbul, the world's Duri Buscarin has more.
Aytan Kaplan uses a sharp knife to harvest thick bunches of dark green sorrel, a leafy green that looks like spinach. Then she hands me a leaf to taste.
Yeah.
It's lemony and crisp, just begging to be put on a salad. Kaplan and her husband Kadir have farmed here for a generation. This section is a piece of land about the size of a swimming pool, sandwiched between a busy road and the crumbling ancient city walls. The city of Istanbul has been slowly restoring the old walls, and in the process, destroyed sections of the gardens. Kadir Kaplan says he's not afraid of the city's restoration project, but his neighbors have already lost land to it. These walls once encircled the Byzantine capital of Constantinople. While defensive and strategic, they were also built to accommodate large sections of arable land to feed the city's inhabitants. An interior area between the inner and outer walls even acted as a sort of protected natural greenhouse. It's in one of these interior sections where Dursun Kaplan kept a grove of fig trees, pomegranate, and winter greens. He's head of the Yedikule Gardeners Association. A few weeks ago, he woke up to city bulldozers uprooting his trees and clearing the area of topsoil. We heard they were just going to restore the walls, that it's just restoration work and nothing more, Kaplan says. No one told us their plans to evict the gardens. His family still has another plot, and they're afraid they'll be evicted from that one, too. We'll fight for what we have left, Kaplan says. That's it. To see the remains of Kaplan's orchard between the walls, a small group of journalists climb up a ladder and through a window. The space has been cleared down to the dirt, with debris strewn to the sides. The city plans to install a walking trail for tourists here when the walls are restored. In a statement, the city of Istanbul's Department of Cultural Heritage said that the wall restoration is necessary because the crumbling structures are dangerous. Irrigation was damaging the bottom of the walls, a spokeswoman wrote. Only the places that are needed to protect the city walls have been evacuated. A citizen-led effort has appealed to the city to protect the gardens by including them in the restoration project, to no avail.
They ignored it. And then they basically went ahead.
Istanbul-based architect Aslıhan Demirtaş says this project is hard to fight because the rights of the gardeners to work the land is based more on tradition than written law.
It's not leasable land. You go and you squat on a certain kind of a land that the state owns, and the municipality, they send you a violation ticket. So the gardeners actually pay that.
Urban development and large-scale commercial projects have been a hallmark of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's 20-year rule. As Turkish cities continue to lose green space every year, tension has grown, says Suna Kafadar, a writer who's part of the effort to protect the gardens.
There's been such a massive attack on any kind of green land and natural resources by way of building mines, by way of building hotels, all sorts of construction projects.
Activists have found themselves fighting to protect multiple city gardens at once, from Istanbul to the southeastern Kurdish-majority city of Diyarbakir.
Especially if you're doing agriculture, of course, it's seen as a rural and backward thing. So the rural and backward are conjoined.
The gardens are being cleared, however, by the Istanbul city government. That's led by Turkey's main opposition party, which will oppose President Erdogan in national elections this spring. And that, Kafadar says, makes it even trickier for environmental activists who are usually aligned with the opposition.
As if we're sort of traitors from within, you know, that's how people view any kind of criticism regardless of it being constructive or not. That's how people view it. You're, you know, we're just approaching the elections, and why don't you just shut up and go for the ride for the next few months? And after they're elected, we can talk about it again.
The Gardeners plan to petition the city as part of a last-ditch effort to stop the destruction. Until then, the fields of winter kale, cabbage, and parsley will continue to grow, just as they have since ancient times. For The World, I'm Derry Biscarin in Istanbul.
Nearly 15 million children have lost one or both parents to HIV or AIDS. Three-quarters of these children live in sub-Saharan Africa. Many communities in this part of the continent often refuse to reintegrate these orphans, especially the ones who are themselves HIV positive. But in the capital of Ghana, Accra, there's a pastor who's established a unique orphanage. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman has the story.
Reverend John Azuma has lived with HIV for 22 years. He says when he was diagnosed with the disease, he thought he was going to die and needed to confide in someone.
I told my wife that, no, we can't keep it as a secret forever. Let's tell our senior pastor. And that was the biggest mistake I did in life.
Reverend Azuma has been a pastor since he was 19 years old. He was 28 when he was diagnosed. He ended up excommunicated, and his family faced a lot of stigma from society. Shopkeepers wouldn't even sell things to his children.
When they go to even buy foodstuff, people say there is AIDS in the money because it's being handled by an AIDS patient.
He says life was tough after he was sacked from his church, but he found a job at another church and was eventually engaged by Ghana's AIDS Commission to lead a campaign against HIV and AIDS stigma. People started reaching out to him about HIV-positive orphans who have been abandoned by their relatives. That's how he ended up founding an orphanage.
Their vulnerability is so high, society reject, families reject, and Motherly Love Orphanage exists to give these children hope.
The Motherly Love Orphanage is a two-story rented apartment with 8 bedrooms. Inside the shelter live dozens of children, all orphans living with HIV, yet very much full of life and aspirations. Some of them gather on the compound to chat and play and run around. 14-year-old Isabel sits quietly. Her parents died of AIDS when she was 5 years old. Her extended family members rejected her and refused to touch her due to the fear of also being infected with the disease. So, she was brought to the orphanage by a Good Samaritan, where life has been much better.
They feed us well, they clothe us well, they take care of us.
Isabel has just completed basic school and hopes to enroll in high school next year. She already seems to have an idea of what she wants to be in future.
I want to be an air hostess.
Air hostess?
Yes.
Why?
I want to see how other countries are, so that I can compare it to my country and maybe see if we can also improve our country too.
In Ghana, government data shows that there are over 230,000 children orphaned by HIV and AIDS, and 29,000 children live with HIV. But there is no dedicated center or orphanage set up by the government that takes care of HIV-positive children here, which is why Reverend Azuma's initiative is one of a kind. It is a non-profit organization. He gets the antiretroviral drugs for the children from the government for free, but has to pay for food, housing, and everything else.
And you know, the cost of our food product in the market today are so high. These children are all in school. They are in private schools, so they pay fees. They buy books, they buy uniforms. Another key thing is medication. They don't take only antiretroviral. You take other essential medicines, immune boosters, vitamin C's, blood tonics, something to help your immune system work faster. So these medicines are expensive.
HIV infection in children occurs most often during pregnancy, labor, or during breastfeeding.
And in fact, when we don't accept them, they go and die. So seeing that I've been able to save these ones and they are alive, they are happy, to even extend, to send two to a university, and that is the greatest joy.
Reverend Azuma believes with more support, he could extend help to more orphaned children with HIV. But Ghana's AIDS Commission says it has serious financial challenges and is not in the position to assist Reverend Azuma's orphanage. Child rights advocate Lilipel Babautu is enraged by the situation.
If you look at it critically, it is the state that's supposed to be responsible for these children. But here you have one man sacrificing everything to secure the future of these children.
Back at the Motherly Love Orphanage, the children continue to soldier on and look forward to the day that they will be embraced by the larger society. Reverend Azuma has just one wish.
If tomorrow I am no more, a home will be built for these children, that even when they go around in the evening, they know that this is my home that I'm going, where nobody stigmatizes me and I'm accepted.
Beyond that, Reverend Azuma wants Ghana to prioritize the needs of orphan children with HIV so that they too can realize their fullest potentials and contribute meaningfully to national development. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Finally today, harrowing scenes in South Africa where seals have been attacking people. In one video, a small seal is seen going after a child on a beach near Cape Town. The seal lunges at the kid's legs as desperate adults try to pull the child away and out of the water. To be clear, seal attacks on people are highly unusual. That's according to Brett Glasby, the Wildlife Management Program Coordinator at the Two Oceans Aquarium in Cape Town.
Generally, seals, particularly these young ones, are very docile, and if they do feel threatened or harassed by people, they will simply enter the water again.
Glasby was speaking with the South Africa Broadcasting Corporation and said it's believed that exposure to a toxin, domoic acid, appears to be causing swelling on the seals' brains.
And the long-term effect is that these animals lose their fear. So instead of running away from trouble, they will take it head on and fight.
The domoic acid is being released during so-called red tides, a problem in many places, as explained in this video from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Red oceans might sound interesting, but red tides are not a good thing. Man-made pesticides and other chemicals people use are washing into our oceans and creating harmful algal blooms.
Red tides can kill marine life, impact human health, and make shellfish unsafe for consumption. And as we have now learned, red tides make South African seals aggressive. There's concern that the impacts on the seals there may be permanent. South Africans have been told to steer clear of seals on the beach. Wise advice generally for people thinking of interacting with wildlife. Know your turf, know the turf of your animal neighbors. Our final thought on this Wednesday. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.